Blog Talk Radio.
What difference if I hail from north or south, or from the east or west? My heart is filled with love.
Earl Wild, who used to play with Charles Toscanini, who was also studied piano and cello, one of the greatest conductors, music conductors and opera conductors in world history. And then Eugene Stoneman, who's not as well known, but is also a very fine pianist, a lot of great recordings. Another interesting death, you see this name on schools, and a lot of people wonder, what is it? And they don't know who it was. And this woman deserves a lot of credit. Sojourner Truth was a black woman around the time of this, I think after the Civil War. She was a woman's right advocate, and she helped people escape from slavery in the South. I think she was connected to the Underground Railroad, which went up into Canada. In fact, when I was up there, there's still, and it's not very well publicized, that there are black Canadians, and these are people who are descendant of the runaway slaves, and they're generally around Windsor, Ontario, which is across the river from Detroit, and it's also used to be the headquarters, North American headquarters, for Hiram Walker, Imperial Distillers, and it's also where Al Capone got his illegal booze, or whiskey, the good stuff, and brought it into the States, illegally, of course, during Prohibition. And today, those of you who are sports lovers, there's two sports historical events today. James Naismith, who invented basketball, he was born today. And Alonzo Stagg was at the University of Chicago, and he was a football coach, and he developed, he invented the huddle. And when one of the, Robert Maynard Hutchins became president, he abolished football. But I think still today there is the football field, I know I haven't been there for a long time, is called Stagg Field. And in that area is where the first atomic chain reaction was affected by the Italian Jewish physicist Enrico Fermi back around the time of World War II, around the beginning. And then this case made Ed Brooke, the first black senator in the U.S. Congress and the first black senator from Massachusetts, who's also, get this, in OSS, light-skinned black, who was in OSS in World War II. That's the Office of Strategic Services, which was the forerunner, predecessor of the CIA. And, of course, there's an interesting connection to the OSS and the probate judge here in San Francisco to the Steve Neri, the U.S. Navy sailor case, which is, they tried to bury it, but it's like Banquo's ghost. It's not going to go away until he gets justice, full justice. Anyway, Albert DeSalvo, who was accused of being the Boston Strangler, he was stabbed in prison, and he died. But Ed Brooke was the state attorney general at the time, and this case made him famous and probably helped propel him into the U.S. Senate. Brooke is dead, I believe. And then we have of the major events today, and this one animal concerned people about animals and animal, what they call animal rights. The first lion was exhibited in the United States on this date in 1716. On this date in 1789, and we're still, some of us are still getting over from Thanksgiving dinner, it was George Washington who established the first National Thanksgiving Day. And then we talked about Alonzo Stagg. And then and on this day in 1940, one of the worst days in history, the Nazis, the anti-Semitic Nazis, believe it or not, there were people who were in the Wehrmacht who were not Nazis, and also in the German Navy, which was less Nazified than the other two services. The Nazis, and after they conquered their part of Poland, forced 500,000 Jews into the Warsaw Ghetto, where they starved them, and disease took their toll on them. When the resistance started and people fought back, the Nazis went in and tried to totally obliterate the ghetto with fire and artillery fire and shooting people. And there were some that escaped and lived to go and help found the new state of Israel. And then on this date in 1973, the infamous Watergate tapes gap, Rosemary Woods in the federal court hearing, I think it was, with federal judge John Sirica, I think he's dead, claimed that there was a gap in the tapes that you transcribed from Nixon's conversation, and this was an 18-minute gap. That's a big one. I guess the tape didn't break. And then on this date in 1991, this is one of the problems with the schools in New York. The condoms were given to thousands of New York high school students. And then getting back to the Jewish issue, it's interesting. I talked about Erich von Manstein, whose birthday was Monday, the 22nd. One of the great field marshals. I think there were there were several that throughout the war in the Wehrmacht. There were also field marshals Milch, M-I-L-C-H, and Milch. He was half Jewish. And the Luftwaffe, and then Donitz. I don't know if there were any in the German Navy. Karl Donitz was Hitler's heir. But among the great field marshals that the Wehrmacht had were von Manstein. We had Rommel, of course, and then you had, this wasn't a field marshal, but you had Stupnagel, who was in Commandant in France, one of the armies. And those of you who've seen the movie The Longest Day, it's a very accurate movie and gives you all these vignettes about the German generals and how they responded or couldn't respond, and then, of course, our people, the Americans and the Brits. And anyway, von Manstein, there's very little we could find out about his mother, even carrying the family name Lewinsky. And, of course, I told you that he was adopted by an uncle who is now buried in the Jewish cemetery and became a von Manstein. The family was originally apparently from Poland. Now, whether what Lewinsky, who had the tete-a-tete with President Clinton, whether this is a sure-tale relative or she's a sure-tale relative, we don't know. But Lewinsky is a Polish-Jewish name, apparently. And there were other, I think the mayor of Berlin, there were what they call Mischlings, half people who had half of their family, either the father or the mother had Jewish ancestry blood or were Jewish. Now, I know a lot of Jews, German Jews especially, who became converted of all things, they converted to Lutheranism. Now, one who was the president, was on the board of my college, Caspar Weinberger, became an Episcopalian. His family was German-Jewish way back. People have a right to convert. And those of us who are stalwart, hang around and stay in the faith, sometimes it's difficult, but it's good to have some spirituality in life, but not to try to impose it on other people like the Islamists try to do and some of these holy rollers. Harry Truman, getting back to him, did not like Billy Graham. And Harry Truman called himself a whiskey-drinking Baptist. And he hated these media ministers. And I had not met Jim Jones, but my brother was briefly involved with him, and he realized that the guy was a flake. And he quickly disassociated himself and got away from that whole crowd before this horrible mass murder, mass poisoning down near in Guyana. And, of course, I will run this clip of the video we have in the archives of that whole period where Dan White didn't trust not only Harvey Milk, but also Jim Jones. And, of course, Harvey Milk was one of the supporters of Jim Jones. Some people claim that he realized he made a mistake, but I can't find any evidence of that. So here, since today, it's very rare that we have really good political humor or even political humor that's not really of the type that's sarcastic or up in your face, but you can have a nice belly laugh. And here is dignified humor by the late President Kennedy, and of course we're going through our archives because this in 1963, I'll never forget that weekend also that he was assassinated. So here goes President Kennedy at where the heck did I do with him? And here we go. at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. I think this was the year before he was assassinated.
The 35th President of the United States, John F. Kennedy, had frequently demonstrated a quick and ready wit. But his audience at the 1962 White House Correspondents' Dinner was unprepared for the high humor he revealed that night. It was shortly after his now famous clash with the steel industry, in which the industry had announced and then rescinded a steel price increase.
I have a few opening announcements. First, the sudden and arbitrary action of the officers of this organization in increasing the price of dinner tickets by 2 dollars and 50 cents over last year constitutes a wholly unjustifiable defiance of the public interest. If this increase is not rescinded, but is imitated by the gridiron, radio, TV, and other dinners, it will have a serious impact on the entire economy of this city. In this serious hour in our nation's history, when newsmen are awakened in the middle of the night to be given a front page story, when expense accounts are being scrutinized by the Congress, when correspondents are required to leave their families for long and lonely weekends at Palm Beach, the American people will find it hard to accept this ruthless decision made by a tiny handful of executives. Whose only interest is the pursuit of pleasure. I am hopeful that the Women's Press Club will not join this price rise and will thereby force a rescission. I'm sure I speak in behalf of all of us in expressing our thanks and very best wishes to Benny Goodman and his group, Miss Gwen Verdon and Bob Force, Miss Sally Ann Howes, Mr. Reed, who has some talent, but... Mr. Peter Sellers. I have arranged for them to appear next week on the United States Steel Hour. I didn't do it. Bobby did it, but we're going to... Like members of Congress, I have been, during the last few days over the Easter holiday, back in touch with my constituents and seeing how they felt. And frankly, I've come back to Washington from Palm Beach, and I'm against my entire program. Would you? I really feel that the only hope in 64 is to, on the Republican ticket, is to nominate Barry. But to be honest, I thought that before I went to Palm Beach. We are glad to have the Prime Minister tonight. Last night he was the guest of the publishers, and again he is tonight. We want him to know... how welcome he is. Lord Dunsany, a distinguished Irishman, said many years ago, to fight England is to fight fate. And I choose to believe in 1962, to be associated with England in a great cause is to be associated with fate. Prime Minister, we are proud to have you here again. We are...
Now, the voices that you heard, the introduction was Chet Huntley, who used to be on NBC. There was a program during the 60s and 70s. In fact, it was one of the first news... And commentary programs on TV. It's called the Huntley-Brinkley Affair. And David Brinkley, I had met many years ago at the American Booksellers down in L.A. I was attending a convention. One of the finest gentlemen, beautiful, rich, deep bass baritone voice, a very fine Southern gentleman, the type, a real journalist, the type you don't see, you hardly see today, and less of this type of fine human being, and professional credit to his profession, if we can still call journalism a profession. It seems to become a PR thing for a lot more and more of these people. You give some of these kids coming out of journalism school a computer, and they're instant pundit. In the old days, as I used to say, and I did it, there's no substitute for shoe leather and running down information and stories and going through files. Of course, today with Google and data banks, it's very helpful, but the information in Google and in these data banks is only as good and as accurate and as thorough as what has been put in it. It's usually from paper. So paper, video, audio, interviews with people who were still around, who were part of that story. We'll have Monday, on a Monday show, a farewell from another great journalist, a real journalist, Eric Sebereit. And he's got some good advice that's still applicable today, and it should be at every commencement of a journalism school. Unfortunately, it isn't, and most of these people coming out of these schools don't know who the hell these people were or are. Edward R. Murrow, Charles Collingwood, Robert Trout. They may know Walter Cronkite. So that being said, getting back to our topic we brought in from last week, today it's the gay sailor who was pardoned had a presidential pardon. I had to do a little research on this one quickie, and it was a German sailor named Wittke, who around World War I, he was, I think, on the cruiser Dresden, which was also raiding, was doing commerce raiding, and he was interned in Valparaiso, Chile. There was a naval battle off of Valparaiso. He escaped to San Francisco, of all places. Then he came across country to New York and was working with Fritz von Papen, who was a guy who always landed on his feet, famous German diplomat. He was also the guy who helped bring Hitler to power and thought he would control Adolf Hitler, but Hitler fooled him. And after the war, von Papen was tried as a war criminal, but again, he landed on his feet and didn't land in Spandau prison where he belonged. Anyway, Wittke was involved in the sabotage in a notorious munitions bomb factory called the Black Tom explosion, and he fled to the West Coast and then into Mexico. He was apprehended in Mexico and extradited to Texas, and he was tried in a court-martial. So there is a jurisdiction and there is legal foundation to try these terrorists in an American court-martial proceedings, military court-martial proceedings. He was tried at Fort Sam Houston, and he was sentenced to death. And in 19, for some reason, he wasn't executed. This was, I think, 1916. For some reason, he wasn't executed. And during the early term of Calvin Coolidge, he was given a presidential pardon. He went back to Germany and was given medals for his military and saboteur services. The gay thing came up, but I couldn't really nail it down, so it just came up, and someone just passing that on. But there have been a lot throughout history, from the time of Colonel Radel, the head of Austrian counterintelligence, Count Esterhazy, who was the went to Saint-Cyr, the French military academy, and he was a gambler. He was married, but he was running a male whorehouse in Paris, and he was a friend of Oscar Wilde, and he set up Captain Alfred Dreyfus, a fellow military French officer, on a spying for Germany. And Dreyfus was railroaded, infamous case, and he was shipped to Devil's Island in French Guiana, where Jim Jones ended up. Although not French Guiana, but in that area of the Caribbean. And it took many years, even with lawyers, And Dreyfus came from a fairly wealthy family. Even with prominent French lawyers and money, he still couldn't get justice for about 10 years. So it's a fascinating story. It is also a Dreyfus case. There are more movies about that case, military injustice, than there are about any of the other cases. Now, in World War II, we had German saboteurs who came in, landed on, off of, I think it was Long Island, and they were caught by a sailor who was patrolling, or a Coast Guardsman. Anyway, they were tried in federal court, and they were sentenced to be executed, the death sentence, and FDR, who was his Attorney General, Biddle, came up with the legal reasoning. FDR also went to Harvard Law School, by the way. He went to Harvard. I don't know if he finished. I forgot to look that up. But anyway, Attorney General Biddle found the legal justification for the execution of these people, and they were executed. I think one or two were pardoned, and they were buried in a cemetery. I don't have the cemetery, but I'll look it up, and because there's a German woman, believed to be German, who comes every year to put flowers on a couple of those graves. I don't know if she's still doing it, if she's still alive. But it's just fascinating that we hear all this fuss about trying these Islamist terrorists in federal military court-martials. And there is legal justification and legal precedent for it if you go back to these cases, which very few people research, and I just came across it by accident, although I'm very fond of Navy military history, having so many of my family in the Navy, our Navy, it is. Next week will be Monday, and we will have memorial mementos of John Kennedy. I'll never forget that, November 22nd, 1963, and I was a student at the time. And we'll have more history, and I hope to have a couple more interviews, and have a Goldwater one that we found in the archives, and it's very funny. Conservatives do have a sense of humor, by the way, and so we'll play that one. So we'll end with the reality of what's real, and of course I should congratulate Willie Brown, the black Texan who came up from Mineola, Texas to San Francisco, was a cab driver, and then went to Hastings Law School, and then became quite an operative, the Huey Long, whom we refer to as the Kingfish, not Amos and Andy, who ran the California legislature. He always wanted to be governor or senator, and that was people who knew about him would do everything they could to prevent him being elected or selected. So what we think he's done is with these three San Franciscans who the Democratic Party who have won or have hijacked this last election through vote fraud, they're all his surrogates. So in effect, we have a Svengali behind the scenes who controls these three people, Newsom, Jerry Brown, and Kamala Harris. Now, we did have a black, Ed Bradley, the mayor of Los Angeles, did run for California governor against Duke Majan, who was from upstate New York. Duke Majan won. He was also a former, and let's do a little politics and poker.
What do you say, Ben? Want a hand?
No, you guys go ahead. I got too much on my mind to play poker.
King bets.
Cost you five. Tony, up to you.
I'm in.
So am I.
Likewise.
Me too. Gentlemen, here we are, and one thing is clear. We gotta pick a candidate for Congress this year.
Big ace.
Ace bet.
You'll pay through the nose.
Okay,
yep, and we will if we don't keep an eye on these this crew that's been elected. This is Peter Paul Brazola. See you Monday. Thank you for tuning in, and this will stay up in the archive.